Welcome back, everyone, to FinTech Mavericks. I'm your host, Nicole Kasperson.
And I'm Drew Glover.
Drew, I've been thinking, every week on the show, I keep hearing a similar theme. Our Mavericks are leveraging content to help drive growth for their personal brands as well as their business.
But let's be real. Most founders don't have the time or bandwidth to execute on that. They're too buried in the grind of running the business.
But that's where the right partner can make all the difference.
Ah, so why don't we hand them the same platform that powers our back office?
All right, listeners, we partnered up with our friends at Brex to bring you something very special, because you too deserve to spend smarter and move faster.
Here's the deal. Open a Brex account to enjoy $750 in Brex travel credits or $450 cash back just for signing up.
And if you're a remote company, the perks get even better. 100,000 bonus points when you deposit 250K into your Brex business account. Then another 25,000 points when you spend 10K on your Brex card.
And on top of the points, you're getting some serious add-ons. 5K in AWS credits, 2,500 in OpenAI credits, plus access to Brex Capital Solutions. Not to mention personalized white glove onboarding to help you hit the ground running.
Wow. Want to learn more? Head to brex.com/fintechmavericks and catapult your business with Brex.
Because if you take the grind out of running your business,
you can focus on telling your story.
Spin smarter.
Move faster.
With Brex.
With Brex. Welcome back, everyone, to FinTech Mavericks. I'm your host, Nicole Kasperson.
And I'm Drew Glover.
Today, we are sitting down with Shivani C. Roya, founder and CEO of Tala. She's raised nearly $500 million to build a financial system that works for the global majority, giving millions of people in Africa, Mexico, India, and the Philippines access to credit for the very first time. Now, Tala has disbursed over $6 billion in credit to more than 11 million customers, with 1 million added in the first half of this year alone. Congratulations on all the growth. She is not only fueling small businesses, but rewriting what financial inclusion looks like at scale. And now with AI and tech infrastructure at the core, Tala is expanding its reach and proving that fintech can be both mission-driven and massively scalable. Shivani, welcome to FinTech Mavericks.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, well, I'm excited to dive in to some of your origin story, your founder lessons, and then, of course, all of your hot takes on what is going on with AI and fintech. So for those that do not know, I actually profiled Shivani in my book, FinTech Feminist, so I know her story quite well. I've seen the TED Talks. We've done a few interviews on stage years ago, right, at like Money 2020 and things like that. And one of my favorite bits about your story is the fact that you interviewed 3,500 people in South Asia and Africa before starting Tala. So I would be curious, diving deeper into that, what is a story or conversation that stuck out to you and maybe the one that really just made you say, I have to go and build Tala?
It's a great question because, I mean, there are obviously multiple. And you know, when I really think about, you know, when I started Tala or this idea of like, I would say I actually unconsciously or subconsciously feel like I started it because I was doing it without thinking that I was doing something. And so to your point, you know, there were these stories and one in particular that I'll share that kind of made me stop in my tracks and made me realize that I wasn't just kind of giving money away or lending to people unconsciously. I had real data behind it and a real reason to believe in this population, which we call the global majority, which is about 4 billion individuals around the world that are really underestimated by traditional financial institutions. And I just share that because it really does represent a $10 trillion market opportunity. And so, you know, I had the opportunity to interview 3,500 people and see what that real potential in real life. But I feel like most people kind of, I think, chalk it up still to development or microfinance. Mm-hmm. So this one individual, her name was Seema, and she was in Chennai, India with me. And I think I'll share why I think it's really an interesting story is that, you know, she was a tile maker and there were other tile makers on the same street as her. And so, you know, in talking to her at first, I was like, well, what makes her different, right? And what I actually realized was not only was she a towel maker, through my conversations with her, she had three other side hustles that were also happening. You know, in that tile store, she also was selling bindis and bangles and all these other little like goodies, because she was also helping plan weddings and kind of celebrations in her community. And so the reason I believed in her potential was obviously I was seeing the consistency behind how she ran her business. So I would go to her store every single day and I would literally sit in her store and see how she ran that business. The number of customers that came in, how much money she made. I would see how much cash she counted at the end of the day. I would go with her to the marketplace, see where that money actually went. But along the way, I was also seeing how she was being so enterprising, how some of that money went back into the tile business. Some of it was going to get this inventory for these other side hustles. And I think that in particular made me realize not only does she have a network, so she's an amazing business owner that she can then sell out to. Two, she's got that consistency and that credibility of the one business. And then three, she's got that kind of willingness and that hustle to kind of keep going and wants to make herself better. The last piece, though, that was the I have to build this piece was, you know, when I would actually go to the marketplace with her, I would see that she would just get turned away. And it was behind the fact that, one, I think, you know, there's the perception issue, which is core to what Tala is actually trying to disprove, which is this idea that the global majority shouldn't get access to capital like the rest of us, and that they can't be true participants. But then the other piece was that legitimately, she didn't have the paperwork and the data that I could actually show to a traditional loan officer. And so that was where I then started to lend to her myself. Right. And I said, you know, there's a huge business opportunity here. So that was my biggest aha moment. And I think the reason I pick Seema in particular is that, you know, a friend of mine came to visit me while I was in Chennai and asked me this question and said, I see Seema, you know, I understand what you see. She's a wonderful woman, all these things. But Shivani, you can't do this for everyone. And that was where all the 3,500 conversations really came together for me. Of me realizing, yeah, I can't lend to everyone myself, right? That's not scalable. Mm-hmm. And so that moment of both seeing Seema, getting asked the question and doing what I was doing made me push towards finding a much more scalable solution to leverage alternative data and think about how do we put the power in our customers' hands, but actually create a platform that can work globally.
Fascinating.
I love that story. And I spent so much time in lending, and lending, I feel like over the last couple of decades, people have tried to find all these different alternative, creative ways of underwriting lending opportunities. Some for the mega rich, other ones for the underserved, right? And so obviously there's a lot of pieces about the conversation that you had with that business owner that aren't scalable that you've worked really hard to make scalable. And I would love for all the nerds listening to get as specific as we can about how we underwrite these individuals to, but also trying to replicate the very personal things that you learned in the process of literally walking to different stores, different vendors, and getting that gut feeling of being like, I can trust this individual, because so hard to do with data. But I know you've spent a lot of time perfecting it to where you can still weigh both pure data and just like that human element.
It's a good question. I think that one of the best ways to weigh both the data aspect and how you actually, again, can create models that can help us split risk at scale alongside the human element is actually to, in some ways, I would say control for the number of variables you put into your models, and also how you think about data ethics and your policies. And so you don't want to create process for the sake of it. That's not what I'm trying to say. But I do think it's really important to create these tensions, right, within your team of saying you've got user researchers that are actually in the markets that are actually trying to understand what are the stories behind what the data is telling us? What's the context of this? Because then as a result of that, you don't just create another black box. So you start to understand what variables, to your point, do move the needle. And are they inherently creating a bias? So as an example, something we learned really early on that is kind of nerdy and weird is that, the number of vowels in someone's name can actually tell us or represent that they might be coming from, you know, a tribal community. They might be coming from a more rural area, right? And, I won't share whether that was a good thing or a bad thing, right? But the point was, it was showing up as creating a bias. Mm-hmm. And we had to then explicitly remove a variable like that. Because our goal is, again, to lend to the global majority, to provide access to financial services to everyone. We truly believe that there is a right financial product, a right price, and a right term for every single individual outside of fraud. And so you have to actually, I think, move fast, right? Bring in data that is scalable, seamless, but you also need to understand it and kind of do these reviews. I think another thing that we get by actually having our product managers and user researchers in our markets is we get to identify other data points others may miss. So as an example, hey, we don't have traditional cash flow data, but what we do have is call lengths. We do understand internal, long distance versus local calls. We do understand the majority of your incoming calls versus the outgoing calls and patterns. And so these can actually be cues for how we think about, you know, how does someone use liquidity? So in the same way as I was actually going store to store and then going with them to the marketplace to understand consistency of bill payments, inventory, these different things, there are different proxies that we can get back into behavior with. And so my background prior to starting Tala, I worked in investment banking, but then I studied data science and econometrics. And so it made me really, I think, maybe approach the solution in a more interdisciplinary way, really kind of balancing both the human side of what I was seeing firsthand with more of the background in data and behavioral economics to think about, hey, this is much more about this person's behavior in the moment, as opposed to traditional scoring is from, you know, something that you've done years ago that you don't even know. And that represents you as a part of a group, as opposed to you as an individual. And so I think that's been core to us is how do we really ensure that we're serving each person from the person up instead of, you know, this kind of blanket solutioning that most do.
Yeah. And one more quick follow-up question on that. I just find this interesting of just how knowledgeable you need to be about specific locations. Obviously, you guys have this global approach, but how, from like a team perspective, and just even diving a little bit more into the underwriting side of things, how are you optimizing for that local aspect of just understanding literally the terrain, like moving around a city, access to different parts of a hyper local area that someone might just be building their business around? But that specific side of it, how physical versus digital is that approach?
I would say now you are going to end up seeing a little more digital. You know, we believe that we should be able to create, global infrastructure, global models that represent similarities. And then you start to customize on the edges. That's the only way to get to, again, 4 billion people.
Of course.
At the same time, I would say that, with the ability to, have, I would say, representation of our team in our local hubs, at least, it allows us to create that scalability. And when we think about expansion, we don't think about it as just like drop in. We do want to understand the market and we want to understand the nuances, the cultural things there. I also really think that where we are with AI and technology, there's also an ability to learn faster than previously. And so, I don't know, it's been 10 years of building Tala. And I think our ethos is one of those that that we will always stay customer first. And we even have a value at Tala called, you know, respect the tapestry, because we do believe it's these subtle nuances and this kind of fabric that comes together in the data to really create the effect and the impact. At the same time, we want to build things and we want to move fast to solve this problem. And so that's the tension that I was talking about before, is within your company culture and also how you organize, how do you create both, you know, to make it successful?
Yeah, no, it's Yeah, I love it. It's fascinating. And to your point, there's so many threads here from what you've already shared that I could pull on, from like the perception issue that you were able to basically crack down on, right? In terms of any traditional financial institution seeing these kinds of borrowers as, you know, trustworthy, and you just like obliterating that with your model, you know, or even the element of like someone at one point telling you that you can't do this for everyone. And then you clearly, I said 11 million or something. What was that again? Right? Like how, yeah, there you go. You're like, oh no, it was 13. Right. Like, however, like that massive amount of millions of people, like anyone, right? Any fintech, any financial institution would kill for those kinds of metrics, right? On their platforms. And you've done it with your own, right? Proprietary data and technology and infrastructure. So clearly debunking that as well, that you absolutely can scale this for everyone. But I also just think the showing of this like alternative data and to your point of the tapestry, right? Like how are we actually gathering those pieces and listening, I think, instead of trying to tell people, if you will, or tell what needs to be done. So I would say like in fintech, we do have this like move fast bias, and we need to move fast. But as we've kind of talked about, like Tala was built through this listening first lens. So of all the things, what do you think that really taught you about scaling differently that maybe you wish you just saw more of in our financial infrastructure?
When I hear you use the term kind of listening alongside move fast, especially in, I think, financial services or fintech today, and, you know, I will say, I think I'm psyched about what I am seeing in terms of infrastructure movement. And really, I would say systems change. Mm-hmm. To me, that is what I started the company to solve. Is ultimately, I'm not looking to build a Band-Aid or just a product that a customer can utilize. Underlying what we do is a vertical stack. It is essentially a platform powering this ability to customize financial products to the masses. And if I had not actually listened and really fully thought through, well, why does this problem occur? This customer that is facing this, you know, I come at it from both the technology side, but ultimately, Nicole, to your point, it's a social justice issue, right? Mm-hmm. It is the fact that we are leaving billions of people behind. And I think with technology, that could happen faster. And so I had to think about, okay, well, why does the person get turned away? Why am I getting told that I can't actually do this? Well, we don't have traditional data. So only 30% of the adult population is even in a credit bureau. So we know that that is not going to overnight change. So we need to find a way to score. Most emerging markets still don't have national ID systems. Mm-hmm. So even doing KYC for a traditional institution is very difficult and costly. And then the last thing is that 85% of the world still spends in cash, in physical hard cash. And so you bring that all together and you realize the magnitude of the system problem alongside the social justice problem. And so I think as I think about, okay, moving fast and listening, it's like to actually move fast, you have to listen more intently. And you have to really, I think, dive into and gain knowledge of why does this actually work? Like, why is this problem occurring? And so for me, I think that's why we built differently, so that our speed could continue to increase, because we solved the system problem versus a product problem.
Put that on a t-shirt, right? Like that's, It's true, right? I mean, we see it all the time. We see, you know, fintechs that will gain some traction and then kind of like flop around later or like never to be seen again, right? Or, and to your point, it's because they're not solving for that systemic issue, that fundamental problem. Like, I know I feel that way largely about just like personal finance apps or like even some of the investing apps, right? Are we like actually solving this, the fundamental problem of like people not knowing, having education, right? Like all of that. And so for you to know that that solving the fundamental systemic issue was what would then create the scale and the move fast that you're able to have, it's just such a maverick way of thinking, because and people don't typically feel or think that way. So I guess it's fascinating to me, like as a leader, how you had that in you. I feel like I know there's some inspiration from your own mother and like seeing her work growing up as a doctor and like serving her community. But that's just like, it's fascinating to me because we just don't see it a lot, you know, this like mindset.
I think for you to, and correct me if I'm wrong here, kind of help solve this systemic challenge, you really had to hit scale. And I think one thing that's really impressive that Tal has been able to do is get to the user, the customer amount that you've hit, and you're continuing to scale at a pretty massive clip. I'd love to just talk a little bit about distribution strategy, how you've been able to scale up. You know, is it been from word of mouth? Have you been doing like traditional paid spend? But like, how are you generally trying to continue to make it so the amount of people that this touches continues to 10x on a year over year, decade over decade basis?
Yeah. Like, how do the rest of us get 11 million in 10 years? You know, like, how do I get a million customers in half a year? What's the secret?
I do think it is about being on one platform, building in such a way that, you know, it can be customized, but it's not bespoke, if that makes sense. And so I think for us, you know, we started in Kenya where a lot of financial infrastructure does exist. But once we proved that we could, again, you know, have a Android solution at that time, that was our only kind of channel initially, customers were downloading it. So high demand for the product, giving us access to key pieces of information through the app, you know, us leveraging that alternative data, scoring them, and then acting as the lender and proving that, again, we could transact with them because we were interoperable, but that the portfolio was profitable. I said, great, but the rest of the world does not exist, does not actually look like Kenya. So now we got to really take on the next challenge. And the Philippines was a very different market, both from a, again, usage of cash. So they didn't have as much mobile money at the time, no national ID system, and also the data that existed in that market was different. And so it forced us, again, to create that end-to-end supply chain and really think, to both of your points, okay, from start to finish, how do we become a part of the daily life of this customer? So we need to not only think about Android, but we need to now start thinking about mobile web. We need to start thinking about retail chains. We need to be thinking about, okay, the data that exists in this market is going to be very different than others. This is where that kind of the local knowledge, the listening to the market really helped us. We had members of our team just pick up and move and actually do what I did in the very beginning, which is follow customers around, understand where they spend cash, where they pay their bills, where they get remittances, and then use technology to then say, okay, we are going to then make it possible for a customer, wherever they are, in whatever form of channel, to download the app, to be able to get access to Tala, like through an application, and then also to be able to get access to the cash that they've been approved of. And so to date, just on just that last piece, I think, which is interesting, just to this piece of accessibility and scalability, we've built our platform in such a way that we now have at least 750,000 different cash in and cash out pickup points. Wow. And so as you, right, as we think about this new technology coming out, like the stuff that's happening in crypto or blockchain, right? The reality is, okay, great, we can move money, but the global majority, they still want to touch and feel their money. They still need that trust that it exists. And so the ability to last mile has to still exist. And so I think that's that piece of, as we think about distribution, we didn't think about distribution just as who can use the product today. We started really thinking about it as we want to be where our customers are at every given point in that financial stack. And so you build with the ability to then add more as the need is actually, you know, showing up. And so now I think it's become super interesting to think of, okay, as remittances flow faster than ever,
yep,
our customer still needs the ability to withdraw those remittances. And so we don't necessarily need to do remittances, but we can be the ones to help them off-ramp those. That creates a new data signal for us. That allows us to better serve them. That allows us to move into different products. And so I keep going back to this thing of we listened, we understood, but we built a platform that now makes us move faster than ever before.
Yeah, I love that. And obviously speed within the fintech space, especially when we talk about anything that touches global fintech, literally the difference of a day is the difference between someone choosing one over the other, the difference of hours. But like we know that sometimes it can be weeks, and sometimes there's fees involved that make it, you know, almost predatory. Also just love just in general from a Tala perspective, that is you get a loan that might start at $30 USD. As long as you keep paying that back on time, your loans continue to expand up to a much higher amount, which also just makes it so, to your point, the user has this ability to really make the product become a part of their life as they're building a long-term relationship where they're getting rewarded for positive engagement.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, at Tala, we call it agency. In the end, you know, at the end of the day, it's like if we can show you the map, but we're not going to be the heroes. We can only enable you. And so that's that piece of it's trust both ways. If we continue to give you value, we hope you do the same back to us, right? And we don't make any money unless our customers actually stay with us and repay.
Yeah, no, it's fascinating. I love the fact that you tackled such a massive systemic issue. To me, that also opens up such a massive opportunity for the scale that you have experienced, and you know, and especially in for the global majority, right? Like you have one solid solution like that, especially when they've been so underserved. Yeah, they're going to tell everyone they know. They're going to tell every entrepreneur on their block, right? They're going to do it for all the side hustles, all the things. So I imagine that like even just that word of mouth has been so, so valuable for you. I know on the other side though, like Shivani, you do a lot of, you do the speaking engagements and you go out there and you speak a lot and, you know, whenever you can. To me, I guess there's like the other side of the scale factor, which is, you know, how do you get, I guess, our industry bought in, right, on the idea, the concept, right, to get the funding or, you know, to get the what you need to scale a business, you know, your business model like this. In a world where, you know, people for some reason decide that anything with any kind of social justice or impact means less money. Here on FinTech Mavericks, we're proving every single episode that it actually means more money. So curious, like, how have you been framing that story and communicating that in your own unique way to the industry, right? Because consumers, like your users, of course, understand. But how, you know, how have you been communicating it, and how has that evolved?
I think the way that I've communicated it has actually stayed largely the same, except having now a lot more proof.
Yeah.
I would say that, you know, it has always been the magnitude of the opportunity. So the population size, I mean, I think it's awesome to be able to come into a meeting and say we have the largest TAM that exists in the market, which is true.
Does right? that work, Drew? Does that work for you?
Yeah, that plays ball. That plays for sure.
Right. And then to say, hey, if we do this with this percent of the population even, and we talk about our, again, now with proof, what our 50-month LTVs look like, right? It's like you can do the math. And I think that's that piece of, again, really laying out, hey, at the highest level, right, even when you're a seed stage founder, to be able to say, here's my unit economics, here's my TAM, right, multiply, and then give me a shot. I think that starts to get you in the door. But then I think you start to really say, hey, and if I can retain this customer over time and actually win their trust, which I think is, again, the huge opportunity here is that, you know, back in the day, right, when we think about, you know, the U.S. market and the remember the concept of joint accounts where parents mm-hmm. and kids were together and remembering that many of those kids never gave up those accounts, right? This represents that same opportunity of the first relationship. Mm-hmm. And I was just going to say, I think that, you know, in fintech, we talk so much about primary account where it's this one account that you put everything into. And I think that's too high of a bar. I actually think it's thinking about it as how can this account get you more leverage? And I think that's the way we think about it, is being the partner to this customer that not only helps them start their journey in, you know, the financial marketplace, but over time actually brings them other products, creates the knowledge and the awareness of how to, again, be financial agents of their lives. And I personally just can say from my experience, like I still have that joint account, right? It's still mm-hmm. where my direct deposit goes, but it's not necessarily where the majority of my money goes. So I think both can be really true.
Yeah, I have mine too, by the way. Although there was a time when, you know, my mother did exit from it, but I kept it because of all that history, right? Like, I also think it just would have generally made her sad if I shut it down for any reason, you know, just keep it alive. So she feels she's still a part of my financial journey. Anyways, but Drew, did you have a question?
Just a couple quick ones. One thing you were saying earlier, you're talking about unit economics, specifically in direct-to-consumer businesses. Mm-hmm. A company knowing that for a VC is like the holy grail, because you remember the years where like somebody would say, I'm going to give you hundreds of million dollars in this round. They didn't really know the unit economics. But now in this market, you're only getting around like that if you know it. Because as a VC, I want to say, if I give you $100 million, I want to know that I'm getting $101 million back guaranteed. And knowing those economics are wildly important. The other one, though, is I 100% agree with this belief that just because you signed up at Bank of America when you were 15 years old once upon a time means that that's going to be your core relationship forever. I have Acorns. I have Robinhood. I have Bank of America. I have JP Morgan Chase. I'm a business owner, so I have multiple other ones, too. And it all goes back to my taxes. There's a million different situations where you're building this wallet. And everyone in the U.S. talks about how do you become top of wallet? How do you become top of wallet? But I think that there's something to be said for being that through point that just lives somewhere in the middle, but it holds the most cherished relationship. And like lending, that's every bank's holy grail. Someone, they want me to open up a checking and savings so one day I'll get my student loan and my home loan, and that's where they really start making money. But what I love about Tala is you're starting with lending first. And so now I'm going to jump to my question, because what I'm most impressed about what you've been able to build is you have some of the most intimate, most important data, global data, which to me, data is like one of the last moats that exists. You have this incredible distribution strategy. One of the last moats that exists is distribution. But that probably gives you so much opportunity to create literally 100 new products every month if you wanted to do it. I'm so curious, how are you staying so focused? And like, what are those products that you're constantly being like, I just wish I could build that tomorrow because of the unfair advantage of data that I have access to?
You better be careful, Drew, because she's going to build it tomorrow. It's going to, whatever she says. Anyway.
I would say that to your point, I mean, maybe to not provide the most specific answer, because we are going to be expanding in that realm. I would say, if you think about the flows of capital, to your point, and this idea that what is our key advantage as a company, it is really about leveraging both our data expertise, so our ability to decision better than anyone in the market, as well as the ability for us to ingest and then utilize that decisioning across the supply chain. So I think really starting to think about it as, okay, we've just continued to, again, amass this amount of longitudinal data. We also understand, I would say, different cohorts, different clusters. We understand, you know, who is actually receiving their remittance at this time of the month, how many those, you know, how consistent is it, what's the amount of it. We also understand kind of savings, we understand pay dates, we understand these different things. So even just within our core kind of liquidity product, how do we better customize that? How do we not create something that's one size fits all and say, we're going to allow you to actually choose your own due date? Like, never heard of in financial services, right? And that's what we do, is literally give our customers the ability to just choose. So they can actually go anywhere between 3 days all the way up, right now up to 6 months, and it's growing. They can see how that changes the price. They can see how much, you know, changing what size product they want to take out versus more or less, how that changes the term or the price. But the point is, actually, I think maybe where we're going is really saying, whatever the product is, how do we actually make it super customized? And the only way to do that is to do real-time decisioning. It goes back again full circle, is like, that's how my brain works, is like, in the same way as we've customized entertainment and gaming and all these different things, why haven't we done that for our financial lives? Like, why does it continue to be that we get put into these boxes? Even for prime customers. And so I think if we can prove it for the customer that's never been served, you know, I really think we get to have that cherished relationship instead of the primary.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I do, especially with AI right now, like, we have the power to personalize things down to like the context of the moment versus it being this really annoying trailing indicator. Like, because I missed a credit card payment for something crazy that happened 2 years ago that shouldn't hinder me from getting a house. Mm-hmm. And we should be catching up to like who we are, who we become. Like, when I met my wife, very different person than who she is today. Who am I to judge her based on, you know, the person I met 10 years ago, who is, you know, again, but it might be a crazy example, but like, we're always evolving and we should be underwritten based on the evolution.
Yes.
Right. Yeah. We don't ask, like, ask our Netflix to like personalize our streaming service based off who I was 10 years ago, right? No, it's like personalizing based off who I am now, which also sometimes shows me things that I loved 10 years ago.
Yeah.
But like, that's right. And the reason I say that is because Shivani is dropping all these little breadcrumbs of clues. So I'm just like, picking up on some clues here. Also because I do have the advantage of your CTO, Kelly Uphoff, was at my leadership summit in New York City and spoke on stage. And she is a former exec at Netflix, where she truly helped with all of that personalization. So she knows AI well. You got a strong CTO there. So it's all, we're all weaving the threads. I'm connecting the dots. Shivani's like, Makaya, don't kill me. You know, all that good stuff. It's all good. You will keep me updated as things happen, and I'm excited to see it all play out. But I'm seeing the dots here. But to that point, I do want to make sure we talk a bit more, even more about AI. As we know, it's everywhere right now. You are obviously, you know, using it in ways to help with the underwriting, to expand the access, to scale safely. I'd be curious about, I guess, your ultimate take here with just, I think, a general big debate that is going on with AI, which is, does AI fundamentally make financial systems more inclusive or more biased? And what are you seeing on the ground?
It's a great question. I think we've in this conversation, we've already started touching on, I think, the bias and the, again, this piece of the context behind the data, the kind of data. I personally believe that, you know, you can have tons of data and you are not going to get a great model. It is all about the quality of the data. Of course, in the world of AI, we do need to think about the amount of data, the depth of that data. And so that also takes time to amass. But it ultimately goes back to what are these models actually being trained on? And so if you don't have, again, good data governance and good data architecture and I would say processes to clean that data, you are going to get kind of bias models, garbage models. And so I think that's been this kind of this part of it, I would say, has been painstakingly hard work for the team. And it has been about, you know, we started this journey in 2020 to essentially overhaul all of our data architecture. And to really, again, make sure that it is integrated into the core, you know, vertical stack or the end-to-end supply chain that we have, so that not only is it high-quality data, we can ingest any form of data, but now we can actually generate our own data. Mm-hmm. So again, that last piece, what's important is that to ensure you're not creating a bias, you don't actually want to be training your data on the data that everybody else has access to. You exactly. also, I mean, that's one, because it's then one and the same, but two, you create a dependency. And you're creating a dependency on macro data sets that you can't ensure the quality of. And so as we, again, want to be able to control our own destiny, expand faster, we need to get to a place where we can control, again, the quality of that, as well as our ability to kind of keep it in our own ecosystem. It also ensures more security for our customers because, again, the models are being trained on their behavior in real time instead of previous behavior that they may have had.
Right, right. Thus solving what we were talking about a second ago, right, is this underwriting for present and future self as opposed to past self and your past decisions. No, I love that. So fundamentally, the debate then goes, AI can make financial systems more inclusive if you are building with your proprietary data, you're funneling that clean data into your own systems and building it for basically yourself, right? As opposed to using what is out there, kind of that, you know, garbage in, garbage out type of situation. Okay, consensus made then, Drew.
I would just ask for the earlier stage founder trying to build in a similar space who doesn't have the ability to have the scale you have of utilizing proprietary data, what kind of advice would you give them in terms of the fact that the majority of the data they have is actually public data and they're building their own proprietary set?
I think to ensure that you're not creating a bias, if that's the question for the early stage founder, I would say, you know, part of it is just that is where you will need to kind of put in internal policies to review models and to prevent algorithmic bias. So early on in our history, when we didn't have our own proprietary data, I'll circle back on that to say you can still create your own proprietary data, even with,
Truth.
You know, macro models, because right. it's also about the kind of interaction features that you create, right? So instead of taking something that is just as it exists and putting it into your model, if you understand the context, you're going to kind of marry features together. And so that is still going to be different. But again, in this, let's say that for some reason that's not possible, then I think it is saying, even as a small team, you know, you can look at the outcome data and you can see if you're having a population bias. So I think it all goes back to what is your mission and vision as a founder? And if those things are important, then you can move fast, but add in like a stop sign.
Yeah. And yeah. I would say even your 3,500 conversations, like that was an early stage founder creating proprietary data. And so there are a million ways to do it, but definitely you're unable to look at millions of accounts. You're having to just, you know, figure out creative ways to create your own set. Mm-hmm, but I love right. that. I love it.
Right. And then with things on the horizon, being able to leverage AI and your own proprietary data that you've now accumulated over having, you know, millions and millions and millions of users and customers. And then, you know, with that next step of how do you create a Netflix like experience, right, for these users, i.e. what is that next best action? Shivani, this is something I've been looking for in my 10 years of reporting on this industry, so I look forward to reporting back whatever we see next, you know, whatever happens next. Yeah, but I'm excited to see that infrastructure just set you up to go bigger and go faster. As we have our last few minutes left here, we're going to jump into some rapid fire questions, a little more personal, a little more founder lessons. But before we do, my last question for you in the proper question format here. You know, building what you've done is not easy. Building in fintech, being a founder and entrepreneur in any capacity, not easy. We all are it. You know, me, you, Drew, we all have this in common. What was one of maybe the toughest moments that tested you as a founder? And what did it teach you about yourself as a leader?
I was, as you were talking, I was like, oh man, she's gonna go there.
Yeah.
I would say, you know, we have a value at Tala, and we've had a lot of moments in our journey to get here. But we have this value called we get to do this, or we choose to do this. And I think I say that just because, especially in the work that we are doing to change financial systems and to change perception, the work is not easy. At any given time, you're really thinking about, okay, how do I balance both the individuals and the impact? How do I think about scale? How do I think about the pressure of the VCs and the funding? And how do I think about, again, continuing to build a business that is generational? And so that kind of tests you, because your brain is actually having to work across, you know, multi dimensions. And so, you know, a strong one obviously for us was COVID. You know, I do go back to it because I think it represented, again, multi aspects of what we're choosing to, what we choose to lean into. So our business literally went from, you know, flying, you know, we were 5 years in at that point, and we went down to $0 in revenue.
Wow.
You know, and then when you think of, okay, that's the customer impact. We're not lending to customers. They're not repaying because they physically can't. We also have salaries to pay, make payroll across, at that point, you know, three different markets plus the US. We had about, you know, 500 plus people at the company. So I'm thinking as a founder, customer impact is currently zero. I now have, you know, and as much as we say as founders, everyone chooses into these things, we still take it home with us, right? That we are supporting families, we are creating jobs. Personal note, I was pregnant with twins at the same time. And, you know, there, it's like you just add, and you actually then have that moment of saying, okay, well, wait, you know, I could look at this as like, this is a catastrophe. Or I could actually think of it as, I was never going to do this. I was never going to be a founder. I found a problem that I couldn't stop thinking about. Right. And that problem was one that, you know, punched me in the gut. And I, back to your first question, I couldn't stop thinking about it. I had to go build it and solve it. And so it then said, okay, well, what are we going to do about it? Right. And that was when we started to, that was when I went to Kelly, our CTO, who was still at Netflix, and said, come build this with me. Let's go rebuild our architecture. Let's go actually transform how our customers can actually, you know, use the money even in lockdown. how can we actually, again, think of this in a much more scalable way? And so it represented a insanely hard time, but this point again of moving fast, if that hadn't happened, we wouldn't have the architecture and this, again, end-to-end vertical solution that is now allowing us to get to these bigger opportunities and create more value that is coming.
Wow. Yeah. All right. Oh my God. What a founder story. Okay. I love that. And so encouraging. And wow, 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 wow. That one didn't make my book. So I'm excited to be able to share that one a bit more. all right. I know we have just a minute left. So we're going to run through these rapid fire questions relatively fast. I'm going to do the first few. I'm texting Drew his round. Boop. And Drew will close this out with his four. Just the first thing that comes to mind, you know. Yeah. All right. Are you ready, Shivani?
I'm ready. I'm ready.
Okay, let's do it. All right. First thing you do when you wake up, are you in CEO mode or mom mode?
Neither. I am in Shivani mode. I wake up and the first thing I do is see the sunrise and I go for a morning walk.
Love that. We love Shivani mode. Okay. More humans on this planet need to hear that. The boldest move you've ever made in Tala's early days that felt reckless at the time, but changed everything.
Lending out our own equity capital to intentionally good and bad borrowers.
That is wild. A fundraising moment that you'll never forget, good, bad, or just straight up brutal.
I will say, let's see. Same person that said it, but one of our partners at IVP, they led our Series B. I went in thinking we were much earlier stage than what they fund, or and you know, went in informational, kind of saying I wanted guidance. And at the end of the meeting, he was like, "No, no, no, you're not too early. Like, we got to do this." And through the process of the diligence, I remember this moment clearly, and this is something that I think all founders or CEOs hopefully have in their time is, you know, he said this sentence and he said, "I can't wait to meet our customers." And he's like, "I just can't wait to go to Kenya."
That's beautiful. And
that was that moment of just realizing like, whoa, we've either crossed the chasm and this thing's going to happen, or two, like he truly just believes in the opportunity too. And it was like just a moment of kind of real validation for me as a builder.
Yeah, no, that is really beautiful. And I think you did both. I think you crossed the chasm and he really believed in it. But gosh, you need those people. All right, let's see. One last thing from me here. What's one assumption people always make about emerging markets that you know is just dead wrong?
I think the amount of purchasing power and the fact that this is a customer base that actually wants to spend and participate.
Mm-hmm. That is 100%. That is 100%. All right, Drew.
A time you trusted your gut over the data and you were right.
The decision to take more risk. So our approval rates across our markets are much higher than what I think others would ever put out. So we have approval rates between, I would say, 40 and 70% across our markets. And most traditional banks, just to put it into context, are at about 13%.
Wow.
So gut-wise, it's believing back in that potential.
Yeah, mm-hmm. and choosing to take more risk in a lending business is such a courageous thing to do. Like
I know.
That just has to be stated. So
I know. You're such a G.
I love that. Wow. I love that. The most underestimated trait in a great founder.
The ability to go seek continuous feedback. Mm. So I think most of us talk of, I think most VCs, most folks will say you really want to have the growth mindset and these things. But I ultimately really think there's this ability to be really curious by learning from your peers and I don't know, just seeking out, not even criticism or feedback, but there's this aspect of just kind of reminding yourself, if, like I say it to myself, right? I have the ability to learn anything. I can actually do that only by being curious about other people's mm-hmm. stories. So I think there's something underestimated about the curiosity aspect as opposed to learning a skill.
Yeah.
It's really rooted in curiosity, 100%.
Yeah. Oh my 100%. Gosh. 100%. So well said.
I'm going to finish it strong. Finish this sentence. The future of financial inclusion is
unleashing the economic power of the global majority.
There it is.
Love.
Love. Love. Love. Amazing. So well said, Sarvani. Thank you so much for everything that you shared, from founder lessons, early days, fundraising things, building AI, all of the things on the horizon that I look forward to continuing to report in the newsletter, and, you know, also hopefully on more stages and shows and all that good stuff. But you have really just proven that fintech can be both world-changing and wildly scalable, especially when we focus on financial inclusion and the global majority. So thank you for showing us that inclusion and innovation do not exist in silos. They actually cohabitate, they coexist, and they fuel each other and fuel profitability. Thank you for being a fintech maverick with us.
Thank you. It was fun.
All right. Yay.